From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And we are now at three members of Congress announcing early departures after allegations of sexual misconduct. Representative Trent Franks, the Republican of Arizona, said last night that he would resign after the House Ethics Committee began an investigation into complaints that he asked two female staffers if they would serve as a surrogate mother for his child. Before that, Minnesota Democrat Al Franken said he'd resign after dozens of members of his own party asked him to, because of allegations of sexual misconduct years ago. And Representative John Conyers announced on Tuesday he'd be retiring after 53 years in office following revelations of a settlement with one woman and allegations of sexual misconduct from others.
Let's start our look at the week there with our political roundtable. Chad Pergram covers Congress for Fox News. Hi, Chad.
Always good to be with you guys.
Great to have you. And Domenico Montanaro, NPR lead political editor, is with us as well. Hi, Domenico.
Hey, guys.
And Chad, let me start with you. How is Capitol Hill, how are Republicans reacting to these latest announcements, especially the one last night from Representative Franks, a very well-known, very conservative Republican?
Well, we got very little comment last night because members were hitting the exits. They had just passed the interim spending bill to keep the government funded and avoid a government shutdown tonight. I spoke both with Kevin McCarthy, the majority leader, and Steve Scalise, the whip on the Republican side of the aisle, and they didn't have any information at that point. It was clear in the statement from House Speaker Paul Ryan that he had been made aware of this about a week ago, had put out a statement and indicated to Trent Franks that he thought he needed to resign. Again, there seems to be this no-tolerance policy, but a lot of members of Congress are asking, is there equal application? You know, there's this question right now about Reuben Kiewan, a Democrat from Nevada, who Nancy Pelosi called last week, asked him to resign, but she let, John Conyers kind of wait a little bit. So people are saying, you know, where is the bar here? And of course, Blake Farenthold, the Republican from Texas, he remains in office at this point. And there is an ethics investigation, a formal ethics investigation looking into Congressman Farenthold now.
Well, let's listen to some of what he has to say about that. He used taxpayer money to settle a lawsuit against his office over allegations of sexual misconduct. He says he'll pay that money back. Here he is speaking to Chris Six News, an NBC affiliate in Texas, this week.
I want to be clear that I didn't do anything wrong. But I also don't want the taxpayers to be on the hook for this. And I want to be able to talk about it and fix the system without people saying, Blake, you benefited from the system. You don't have a right to talk about it or fix it.
By the way, that's probably KRIS, Six News, there in Texas. But Domenico, to you, Farenthold hasn't faced the kind of pressure to resign that toppled Franken. Talk about the different approach to this.
Well, you know, he did settle a harassment case. Now, the ethics investigation is taking a look at it. And, Speaker Ryan's office has said that they see a slightly different set of allegations here or unsubstantiated, which is what Farenthold says anyway. So there are all of these cases, case by case, that they're all looking at. I mean, the case of Trent Franks, for example, Ryan's office was very quick to push him out, even boasting of that in a statement last night. And you have to wonder that whether or not there was more to the actual story there than just simply talking to staffers about the potential for surrogacy and what other comments were made. You know, by resigning, the ethics committee doesn't look at it because it's no longer part of the person's no longer part of Congress, and they only look at what happens when you're part of Congress. So, you know, even Kirsten Gillibrand, the senator from New York who sort of led the charge against Al Franken, said, look, this is a case-by-case basis. We don't know, the bar is being figured out as they go. And I think a lot of workplaces are dealing with that as well.
But there was clearly a strategy on the part of the Democrats because the number of Democratic senators who came out at the same time and said it's time for Al Franken to resign. Chad, do Democrats feel that this is going to be a winning issue for them because they got Al Franken to resign over allegations when people like President Trump are still in office?
Well, I just want to jump in and point out the Quinnipiac poll this week found 70% of Americans think Congress should investigate sexual harassment allegations against the president. So to Jeremy's question, is this a strategy on the part of the Democrats?
Well, Democrats want to be on the best footing possible if they have to deal maybe with the seating coming up of Roy Moore, the Republican candidate for Senate in Alabama. That special election is Tuesday. Note that Senator Franken did not give an end date. He didn't say, I'm going to leave on this particular date. We have had other people say that they're going to resign and then not resign, most notably Larry Craig, Republican senator from Idaho, who was picked up in a sex sting in the Minnesota airport bathroom several years ago. You have had other members resign conditionally. David Wu, who is a Democratic congressman from Oregon and also got caught in a sex scandal. He said he would resign later in 2011 after they finished with the debt ceiling. But that was the interesting thing. It seemed like there was one more allegation, just one too many allegations regarding Al Franken, and the dam broke. I thought it was interesting when I spoke with Mazie Hirono, who's a Democratic senator from Hawaii, and she indicated that she had a statement prepared, past tense. In other words, she was kind of waiting to see if what happened here. And if Moore wins, some people here at the Capitol, and we have no evidence to this, but there's a lot of chatter. There was one member of the Minnesota delegation who said, I'm worried that Al Franken won't resign because if Roy Moore is, in fact, elected next week, he might say, well, I'll step aside when Roy Moore steps aside.
Yeah. Well, that's fascinating. But you mentioned Roy Moore. The National Republican Committee gave its financial support back to him this week after President Trump endorsed him. He's, of course, been accused by 9 women, one of as young as 14. Here you're speaking at a rally in Fairhope, Alabama.
See, what I think they're afraid that I'm going to take Alabama values to Washington. And I want to tell you, I can't wait.
Domenico, so we just heard Chad's, the chatter that Chad is hearing that perhaps the Democrats are waiting to see if Roy Moore wins to make another chess move there. But analysts are saying Roy Moore is taking a page from the Trump playbook, you know, accusations against him and just plowing on, and he might have the same success.
Well, it's kind of what else can he do? You know, I mean, he's just sort of taking from the Trump playbook of saying, you know, if you just say it, people will believe it, which, half the country does and half the country doesn't in the partisan atmosphere that we live in. I think Democrats are trying to take the moral high ground by forcing out Franken and by forcing out John Conyers of Michigan, especially ahead of that election in Alabama. The poll that you mentioned about 70% of the country looking at wanting Congress to investigate the allegations against President Trump, overwhelmingly Democrats said so, 86%. Two-thirds of independents said so, 66%. Only 39% of Republicans, though, said that they believed that Congress should investigate these allegations against President Trump. And that's the kind of world we live in at this point.
Keep in mind here that this is also not necessarily, you know, Roy Moore taking from President Trump's playbook here. Roy Moore was doing this sort of thing long before when he was on the state Supreme Court in Alabama and running there. You know, we have another emerging, you know, topic on this. Beverly Young Nelson, who is one of the Roy Moore accusers, said this morning that she added the inscription in the yearbook. And now this is a crack in her story. She's not recanting
That. Explain that. There are two women who have come forward with yearbooks and said that Roy Moore, when he was in his 30s, signed their yearbooks when they were just teens. And so what is she saying?
Right. She's saying that she added the inscription. There was some question about the date as to when this may have been signed. And so when did she do that? That's a question. And, of course, the Moore folks will see this as a crack in her story and gives them a chance to attack her and attack her credibility.
Well, and we heard from Roy Moore. Let's hear from Doug Jones, who's the Democrat who's running in the race. Here he is at a rally in Montgomery this week talking about supporting women.
I believe they deserve equal pay for equal work, and I damn sure believe that I have done my part to ensure that men who hurt little girls should go to jail and not the United States Senate.
By the way, a program note, we will be broadcasting from Birmingham, Alabama on Monday. I'm heading down there this weekend. But Domenico, is it possible that Doug Jones could win this race?
Sure, certainly possible. And I think about 3 weeks ago, Democrats were more hopeful that that was going to happen. Polling has been all over the place in the state, and it's really not something you can pay much attention to. This is a state that certainly favors Republicans, certainly favors President Trump. He's did very well there. This is as red a state as it gets. Jones, though, because he's tried to be a little more centrist and because of these allegations against Moore, a lot of people expect a pretty close race.
Chad, we only have a minute here. We've got so much going on. The government shutdown has been averted for a couple of weeks. Republicans trying to hash out a final version of their tax plan. The investigation into Russian interference in the election goes on. Give me one thing in the minute we have you're looking for next week.
Well, how do they keep the government open by December 22nd? The House passed that interim spending bill 235 to 193. There were 18 Republican no votes on that bill. Had they had one more, they wouldn't have been able to carry the freight on their own on the Republican side of the aisle and would have needed Democratic votes. They did it on their own. Now, it depends what the next spending bill looks like. And this is where Democrats are saying, if you can't provide the votes, even though you're in the majority, you're going to have to come to us. And that's where Luis Gutierrez, a Democratic congressman from Illinois, is saying, I'm not responsible for the Republican dysfunction here. If you want to do this on your own, fine, deliver 218 votes. If not, we need a DACA fix attached to this piece of legislation.
So it's going to be another exciting Christmas time to be in the news business.
What a present.
Chad Pergram, who covers Congress at Fox News, and Domenica Montanaro, NPR lead political editor. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you.
Thanks,
You're
guys.
Welcome.
Thousands of protesters took to the streets today in Jordan, Egypt, Iraq, Turkey, Malaysia, Pakistan, Indonesia, Somalia, and elsewhere. After Friday prayers in the Muslim world, and in response to President Trump's recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital, the first world leader since the country's founding to do so. There were clashes between Palestinians and Israeli forces in Jerusalem and in the West Bank cities of Hebron, Bethlehem, and Ramallah. The BBC's Yolan Nell is in Jerusalem, and Yolan, we know you're back in the bureau now, but what did you see on the streets?
Well, I was in the old city of Jerusalem, which was tense after Friday prayers, Al-Aqsa Mosque. There was a very visibly increased Israeli police presence all around the occupied east of the city. But what we saw were just some scuffles, really, and apparently some arrests being made as well by Israeli special forces. We've seen clashes, too, between Palestinians and Israeli soldiers, all the usual flashpoints across the West Bank and Gaza in the past couple of days. I've been along to some rallies that have turned violent, mostly Palestinians throwing stones, Israelis then using tear gas and rubber bullets in response. In Gaza, there were protesters who earlier approached the border fence where Israeli soldiers responded by using live bullets, and we're just hearing that one person has been killed there. But I have to say, so far, these protests are not the biggest we've seen, even in recent times. They certainly don't amount at the moment to a third intifada or uprising, which is what the Islamist group Hamas has called for.
Well, and by the way, you said occupied East Jerusalem. It was occupied by Israel in the 1967 war, but Palestinians claim it and hope it to be the capital of a future Palestinian state. According to BBC reporting, there are now 330,000 Palestinians living in East Jerusalem, and again, President Trump has declared Jerusalem the capital of Israel. There are about 200,000 Israeli Jews who have those controversial settlements there. So all of, you know, these stories that we've been reporting on for years are culminating in this moment. What do you think happens?
We have to wait and see to some extent at the moment. I mean, a lot of Palestinian protests that have happened recently have fizzled out. What's important to know today is although there was this increased security presence, Israel didn't take any action to put new restrictions on Palestinian worshippers going to pray at the Al-Aqsa Mosque. That is a really sort of important point. I was speaking to Palestinian worshippers who were deeply troubled by Mr. Trump's recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital. There was one man at Damascus Gate who told me, Trump is crazy. He wants to make war, not peace. Washington doesn't decide here. This is an Islamic city, a Christian city, and an Arab city, he said. But then you contrast that to what another man said, an Israeli who'd been praying by the Western wall when I walked to the other side of the old city, he told me that this U.S. move was long overdue. I was also on West Jerusalem in a busy shopping area, and there people were really very happy that there had been this U.S. recognition. One woman said so many past presidents were lily-livered. They promised this on the campaign trail, but when they came to office, they backed down, and they were very happy with the idea that the U.S. would be moving its embassy.
Which was also part of President Trump's announcement to eventually, it would take years, move the embassy from Tel Aviv to Jerusalem. Yolan, it does sound, though, as if you're saying it's not as bad as it could be.
That's very much the case at the moment. The fear here is always that there could be some incident which causes an escalation. That is something that's happened in the past. The mood on the street, people are calling, that I spoke to in Ramallah a day ago, for an end to ties with the U.S. But then you have to remember that they've been told, the Palestinian leadership, repeatedly by Mr. Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, by the real estate lawyer, Jason Greenblatt, on visits to this region, that they are working on a Trump administration peace plan. They've been working on it for the best part of a year. And one of the tests for what happens next is, of course, a visit by Mike Pence, which is due to happen in the middle of this month. He's due to visit Israeli officials here in Jerusalem, but also meet the Palestinian president in Bethlehem. And the latest we heard from the White House was that there hadn't been any cancellation of a meeting with Mr. Abbas, that would be counterproductive. But then we've had senior officials from the president's Fatah faction saying that Mr. Pence is not welcome in Palestine. The president's spokesman has also been quoted as local media now saying Jerusalem is more important than the U.S. administration. We will not concede it in return for a meeting with the vice president. And I was having a chat with a Palestinian official who told me that Mr. Pence is particularly unpopular with the Palestinian leadership. He's considered to be very hostile. Of course, he's from the evangelical Christian pro-Israel wing of the Republican Party, which has really supported this recognition of Jerusalem as Israel's capital. And this official was telling me that the mood on the street was that any visit by Mr. Pence would really set the government, set the people against the government.
Well, and of course, they probably all saw the image of Donald Trump making his speech with Vice President Pence standing right behind him in a Christmas-decorated setting at the White House. The BBC's Ilan Nell in Jerusalem, thank you.
You're very welcome.
Well, there are about 190,000 people from El Salvador living and working in the U.S. under a federal program called Temporary Protected Status, or TPS. That's according to the Pew Research Center. The Trump administration recently canceled TPS for three other countries, and now a deadline looms in January to decide what will happen to Salvadorans with TPS. Matthew Casey from member station KJZZ reports on a Tucson, Arizona man who's been in the program for 16 years.
Gabriel Navarrete straps an industrial vacuum on his back. It's Friday night, and when dental offices close, Navarrete opens his cleaning business. He says it's a lie when people say Latinos come here to take their jobs. Navarrete is an educated and intense man. To keep his customers, he knows he has to be efficient and pay attention to small details. On the lighter side, he's a basketball fan.
Los Angeles Lakers.
The 55-year-old Salvadoran wants to grow his business and plan retirement, but he has to wait for the Department of Homeland Security to decide if it will extend or cancel the temporary protected status he's had for almost two decades. He says we could lose two houses, businesses, and everything we have. DHS grants TPS for up to 18 months. Navarrete has lived through at least 10 cycles since 2001, after the U.S. gave Salvadorans TPS after several earthquakes.
Tenemos que salir de esa incertidumbre.
Navarrete says we have to get out of this uncertainty. The Trump administration recently announced plans to end TPS for Sudan, Nicaragua, and Haiti. It gave a six-month extension to Honduras, but said people should prepare to go home. Salvadorans, who make up the largest number of TPS recipients, will learn their fate in January. Navarrete's wife, Guadalupe Ponce, is from Mexico. She met Navarrete at a late-night cafe. They've been married for 11 years. Ponce says her husband has been stressed about TPS for months. Sometimes his blood pressure goes up a little, she says. He sleeps, but not well. Navarrete is right to worry about losing TPS, says Cecilia Menjivar, a sociologist at the University of Kansas who spent 20 years studying the program. She says El Salvador is worse now than it was in 2001.
There is more violence now. They could go back to a country that is absolutely not ready to receive them because the economy is so weak still.
TPS advocates, like the Center for American Progress, say TPS recipients are key contributors to the U.S. economy. The organization released a study that found the U.S. could lose $164 billion worth of gross domestic product in a decade if the government cancels TPS for El Salvador, Honduras, and Haiti. Supporters also say authorities constantly vet recipients, many have kids, and like Navarrete, many own businesses too.
And for most people on TPS, they have been in the country for at least half of their lives, if not more.
Critics of the TPS program say U.S. ties should not matter. They argue TPS extension should only depend on what's happening on the ground in the home country. Andrew Arthur is a resident fellow in law and policy at the Center for Immigration Studies, which advocates for lower immigration.
Respectfully, the interests of the individuals who are in the United States, who are in that status, also really should not be considered.
Arthur is a former immigration judge and INS lawyer. He argues that there are millions of out-of-work Americans who can replace TPS holders in the job market, and says years of extensions for countries like El Salvador gave people quasi-permanent status that actually hurts other countries' chances of getting TPS in the future.
I believe that it makes it less likely that countries that would benefit from 6 months TPS are actually going to get it because there's a danger that it's never going to end.
Every time the government gives an extension, longtime TPS holders have to also prepare in case the program gets canceled.
It's definitely temporary. It's only for 18 months typically. And so people are in constant anxiety when you get close.
Phoenix immigration lawyer Judy Flanagan has had TPS clients for 20 years.
Seems cruel, actually, to make people go back.
As he mops the long hallways of a doctor's office, Gabriel Navarrete argues the U.S. owes El Salvador for letting the military operate there in the 1980s. And it's one reason why TPS recipients should get to become citizens. I believe it's fair that we're offered something for that, he says. If he loses TPS, Navarrete says he won't go back to El Salvador. I would try to go to a calm part of Mexico, he says. Navarrete won't know his fate until January. But even if TPS gets extended for people from El Salvador, it will only mark the start of a familiar cycle with an unknown ending. For Here and Now, I'm Matthew Casey.
This week, Google pulled its video streaming service YouTube off of two Amazon devices. It's part of an ongoing fight between the two companies. Amazon has long refused to sell competing Google products on its website. Ben Johnson reports on tech for Here and Now. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Jeremy.
And tell us first more about what just happened this week, about what YouTube and Google have done here.
Yeah, so they're in this spat, Jeremy. And for Google, this seems to go back to something that's been happening since 2015, when Amazon, which of course has this massive online retail power, decided to stop selling Google's Chromecast, this little dongle you plug into your TV to stream online videos. But more recently, Amazon has also refused to sell the smart speaker, Google Home, and some of these other smart home products that Google makes, cameras, thermostats, or I should say Alphabet makes. This is Google's parent company. They're made by Nest. And a statement from Google about the move to remove YouTube from these two Amazon devices this week said it had pulled YouTube off these devices because of a, quote, lack of reciprocity.
And how is Amazon responding?
Amazon, in response, said in a statement that Google is setting a, quote, disappointing precedent by selectively blocking customer access to an open website.
Is there any way around it for consumers?
Yeah. So the short answer, Jeremy, right now, luckily for me, I don't actually use either Fire TV or the Echo Show. But if you do, you can, for instance, just access YouTube through the good old fashioned web instead of the app, which Google has removed. And you can always buy Google products from Google itself. This is not that hard. It's less convenient, but you can do it on Google's Play Store. And this is not just Google and Amazon, by the way. Important to point out here that after a long time, Amazon's Fire TV app finally works in Apple TV. This has been announced a while back, but now it's going to start working. That means Apple TV users can finally watch Amazon programming easily. So, you know, regular users, you win some, you lose some, I guess.
Are we likely to see any kind of resolution to this argument between these two giants, or will this go on the way that, you know, there's been an ongoing feud between Apple and Samsung?
I think this small spat will get resolved. And honestly, it's kind of rare that these things pop into the public view anyway. Usually these big tech companies kind of wheel and deal on this stuff behind closed doors, and we deal with it as users without really knowing who is unhappy with who. We just get the consequences. But this is a reminder of this like huge war that sort of defines this era of big tech companies that we're in right now. They all kind of make the same kind of stuff, TV streaming devices, software that assists you with the help of smart speakers, and on and on. And this is my opinion, but generally speaking, I think it's a good thing when these different products from different companies play nice and work with each other. It allows consumers to use the products that work the best for them. That's also how a competitive marketplace can give us the best products. But the truth is, Jeremy, this might not get worked out because we're now in this era where these tech companies are all using things like voice assistants to suck in your data and do everything for you and profit from that. We might be on the verge of a world where you actually have to choose which tech giant does all of your computing. And I think that kind of walled garden future is one that lines tech company pockets and doesn't do much of anything for you and me, but it is a potential future.
That's Ben Johnson, who covers tech for Here and Now. Ben, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
It's time now for a classical edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions. Vic DiGeronimo is a DJ and host of Classic Mornings on WILL in Urbana, Illinois. He's back with us once again. Hi, Vic.
Hi, Jeremy. It's great to be back with you, as usual, you and your audience.
Well, it's great to have you. And you are calling this the year of the eclipse, and you are not referring to the eclipse that many of us saw back in August. Instead, this is an eclipse of some of the most famous classical works. Explain.
It is the year in which major anniversaries for some of the greatest pieces in the classical music repertoire are perfectly aligned, and you could say that it sort of eclipses all the other celebrations this year musically.
Okay, well, let's hear some of the examples that you brought us. This is George Frederick Handel's Water Music, performed by the Academy of Ancient Music, Berlin. Now, this year marks the 300th anniversary of the first performance of this piece. What do we know about that performance?
Oh, what do we know about it? It was spectacular. It's the Thames River in London. King George I and his entourage are on a barge. And there's a separate barge with something like 50 musicians on it. And they're playing this music by George Frederick Handel, which had to be repeated three times through the evening. It was requested that it be repeated. And something like an hour's worth of music, twice before dinner and once after. What's interesting, Jeremy, is that Handel never published the music. We don't have an autograph manuscript. And this music was immensely popular in its time. So what we have today, the three suites of music from George Frederick Handel's Water Music, have come to us from arrangements by others at the time. And it's miraculous that we have this music, which has become one of the most popular works in the classical music repertoire.
Okay, well, next we have the Overture to the Thieving Magpie, composed by Gioachino Rossini and performed here by the London Symphony Orchestra. What a thief that magpie is.
There actually is in the opera a magpie that steals a silver spoon. Hmm. So this is not just a figurative use of magpie. This overture is a concert staple, and it's 200 years old this year. It wasn't written until the day of the performance, and Rossini told this story years later, that he was locked in a room, and he was told to write the overture and to drop the pages one by one out the window for the copyists. And if he didn't drop the pages out the window and finish it, they were going to drop him out the window. So it's kind of a little bit of drama there in the home stretch of getting the overture finished for the opera.
All right, so the first one we heard was performed 300 years ago. This one, 200 years ago. Now let's go to one that was 150 years ago. This is the Blue Danube Waltz, written by Austrian composer Johann Strauss II. Here it is, performed by the Vienna Men's Choral Society and the Czechoslovak Radio Symphony Orchestra. Czechoslovak, we'll get to that in a second, doesn't exist anymore, but it did when this recording was made. What a well-known piece at this point. I'm just thinking of how many movies and probably cartoons that has been in, but it's been around for 150 years.
It has, and a lot of folks are probably wondering why they're singing it. Originally, it was written for men's chorus, a cappella men's chorus. Then Strauss decided at the last minute to add a piano part, and then he, even later than that, decided to add the famous orchestral introduction and accompaniment that we know today. It was performed during carnival time, and the lyrics had nothing to do with the Blue Danube. The phrase was borrowed from a poem of the time. It was about a month later that Strauss made the orchestral version. It was then performed in a park in Vienna, and the rest is history. It was 25 years later that lyrics that actually had something to do with the Danube were added, and those are the lyrics that you heard sung just a moment ago.
What are they singing about?
They're singing about the Danube, but originally it was there were satirical lyrics for at the time the Austrian army had been defeated by the Prussian army, and there were sort of low spirits at the time, and it was something that was supposed to sort of spark spirits of the citizens at the time.
And by the way, Czechoslovak, referring to Czechoslovakia, which doesn't exist anymore, now it's the Czech Republic and Slovakia, but is that orchestra still around?
Well, it's now known as the Slovak Radio Symphony Orchestra of Bratislava.
Okay, well, we have time for one more, and here is one that we're going to hear a lot in the next month, Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker Suite, performed here by the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra. Now, going with your theme, this was first performed 125 years ago?
It was performed 125 years ago in the month of March. It was performed in the month of March. The suite from the ballet. I call it the greatest preview in history. Tchaikovsky presented in the concert hall the famous suite that we know, which consists of excerpts from the ballet that would not be performed for 9 months yet. And this was in St. Petersburg in March of 1892. And then in December, the complete ballet was presented for the first time.
And I must say that even people who listen to just a little bit of classical music probably have heard all of the pieces that you brought us. Why have these stood apart in terms of longevity and popularity?
For one thing, they're great tunes. And these particular pieces, be it the orchestration, be it the melodies, be it the drama in the music in some cases, they've withstood the test of time, and the performances are very special. And I think even those who have heard these pieces many, many times are always looking forward to hearing a recording featuring a new orchestra, a new ensemble that brings something else unique to the performance.
That's Vic DiGeronimo, a DJ and host of Classic Mornings on WILL in Urbana, Illinois. Vic, thanks as always.
Jeremy, it was my pleasure.
And you can find all of our DJ sessions at hereandnow.org.
President Trump has declared a federal emergency in Southern California at the request of that state's Governor Jerry Brown. There are now 6 major wildfires burning. The Lilac Fire broke out yesterday north of San Diego in the rural towns of Bonsall and Oceanside, threatening nearby Camp Pendleton, killing at least 12 thoroughbred racehorses at San Luis Rey Downs Training Center. It's feared that number is going to go much higher. John Sepulvedo of KQED is at the Lilac Fire staging area. John, a rural community, this horse loss is just terrible. But what are you seeing?
We are seeing no fatalities for people, which is good. And what I am seeing is a lot of smoke creep in. So it's getting a lot warmer here right now, Robin. It's going to be about 80 degrees to 85 degrees. And we're seeing a lot of smoke fill the valley. As the ground heats up and as the wind shifts, we're going to see the fire kind of push back inland. And that's the concern because there are big population centers. And in fact, the area where this is at is, you know, outside of Florida, it's one of the highest per capita retirement areas. In fact, they have a center not too far from one of those fires happening called the Lawrence Welk Center, which is a old retirement home that's been there for a long time. There's a Sun City, Del Webb Sun City retirement community, not too far up the road from here. So there's a lot of concern about making sure people who might not be technically savvy, as there's some concern of that from law enforcement, to make sure that they know that a fire could come, that they might have to evacuate. So we're seeing a lot of police presence here, so because they're the people who have to go door to door.
Well, that's what we saw in Northern California during the wildfires there, so we'll keep an eye on that. But meantime, you know, you've also got the Thomas Fire, which was the first in Ventura County, and it's the biggest. And you've got the Skirboil Fire, which is small, but it, you know, it's the one you talked about with us that, you know, shut down the 405 freeway and is threatening the Getty Center there, the museum. What's the sense of how soon will the winds die down? How long is this going to last?
Well, it's going to last through the weekend. And this is what has been so frustrating for the people who are fighting these fires and for the people who are waiting to go home. Is that every day? So the winds were originally supposed to be, today was supposed to be earlier in the week, the last day of really intense winds, you know, winds more than 60 miles per hour. Then that got extended to tomorrow, Saturday, and then it got extended again to Sunday. So those unfavorable conditions, I mean, that's a big reason not only why President Trump signed the state of emergency to get more money and more resources, you know, for fixed wing aircraft and that, but the reason that Governor Jerry Brown has been really harping on the issue of fire funding, not just in California, but for the West.
Well, little loss of life, but there has been one confirmed death?
Yeah, there's been at least one confirmed death by the flames. This woman was found in Ventura County late yesterday. One of the things that I've really just been amazed at is these fires are brutal. The smoke, heavier than what I saw in the North Bay when I covered that, and the deadliest fires in California history that we know of. The winds, more intense. The flames, actually hotter. But what has been phenomenal is the fact that there has been very little loss of life up to this point. Comparatively, it seems that first responders have learned a lot from the Northern California fires about getting people out early, and we saw that in Ojai just a few days ago. They evacuated the town, even though they might not have needed to. There was no chance was taken. You know, that was definitely something that didn't happen quite fast right. enough in the North Bays.
Well, perhaps the fires in the north are impacting people down south. Look, but terrible loss of animals. There was another barn that burned down because of the creek fire. That's in the Cagle Canyon.
Right.
40 horses killed there. So other losses there as well. Schools closed. Talk a little bit about how it's impacting people.
You know, it's doing two things. One, there's the immediate impact of, okay, I need to have a go bag ready. Okay, I need to be ready to evacuate. I need to make sure that I have a plan for my animals. And then once that gets done, it's almost like this has become very, like, normal. It's really important to keep in mind that since January, so it's almost a full year, there has been significant smoke events in the West, and many of those in California. And I feel, when I talk to people, that it's kind of shocking to see these big plumes of smoke that you can actually see from downtown Los Angeles up these massive flames. But then people kind of forget it's there.
Well, and we just want to mention the firefighters, well more than 5,000 at this point. They've come in from other states. But if the fires continue to spread, I mean, how do they do this?
Yeah, I mean, that's what this emergency declaration does, is it helps free up the money that's needed and help basically tap into federal resources for coordination and for equipment. I mean, it's really, really important. I cannot say enough positive things about the firefighters. I mean, these people have worked their butts off, and they have saved towns, and they have done it through the night. I've seen firefighters sleeping for 15-minute periods and then turn around and get back up, and they deserve a big shout-out. They work incredibly hard. They don't have enough resources. They can never have enough resources. And the work is incredibly dangerous.
John Sepulvedo of KQED in San Francisco, but for us covering the fires in Southern California down there at the Lilac Fire in San Diego County. John, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
My friend Beth out there in California, Jeremy, is working on a bumper sticker, Hug a Firefighter. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.